So this is where it all happens, right? The artificial intelligence in Silicon Valley, and some of you probably are working at that and looking at the work of your hands and wondering, what have I just made, you know? And can it become self-conscious? Can it talk back at me, perhaps, you know? And those questions, as contemporary as they might seem, are not completely new. I mean, just think of Frankenstein's monster, right? I mean, there's also an artificial making of material things, and in this case, the assumption was it does come to a kind of a self-consciousness. There are even older stories like the old Gollum story of the Jewish tradition. So not Gollum from Lord of the Rings, but from the Jewish tradition, where they make this huge man out of clay and they put the word of God in his mouth and he comes to life. And they even argue things we argue now about whether they should give them legal rights or legal standing or moral standing. So these questions are not completely new. They have been around before. But of course, we do that now in a much more systematic and almost industrial level kind of fashion. So are then, is there a possibility that computers could be persons, that they could have a soul, that they are conscious? And how would we even go about answering such a question? One first approach might be just with our normal intuitions. And I found a little formulation by Alan Turing in his famous article that gives a whole list of these. Some are more plausible than others, perhaps. Here is it. So this is what they cannot do. That be kind, resourceful, beautiful, friendly, have initiative, have a sense of humor, tell right from wrong, make mistakes, fall in love, enjoy strawberries and cream, make someone fall in love with it, learn from experience, use words properly, be the subject of its own thought, have as much diversity of behavior as a man, do something really new. So about all of these, one could, of course, talk, and I will come back to some of those, actually. But that is sort of a first approach just by intuition. And indeed, you know, have you ever felt that the need to apologize to your computer? Probably not. Or have you ever felt tempted to tell your computer a joke? Maybe not, but then perhaps we ought to, you know? Or if you think of that driverless car that recently killed someone, would we think that car should be put on trial? If it were a person, you know, we would. Or if you turn your computer off, do you ever feel remorse for having just killed your computer? There are actually some serious questions. If they are persons and that is what that means, you know, then how about us? Can you switch us off, let's say, you know, at the end of life? So there are actually real life questions that come out of really making that parallel. So again, where do we even begin? Is it a matter of intelligence? We call that artificial intelligence. And that can be misleading because we think of, say, the level of IQ that something has, the rate of performance, how well they do on X, Y, or Z. Well, if that's the criterion, then they're probably more persons than we are, because they already outperform us in so many things, including playing chess. Perhaps that's not the right approach. And so my question is more, is not so much what can they do? I'll grant all sorts of things in that regard that they probably can do. My question is, what are they? It's not about doing, but being. And that is not really being answered by the Turing test. So the Turing test is basically, if you cannot distinguish anymore whether you're talking to a real person or to a machine, that just tells you how good the machine is at simulating a real human person. But simulation, by definition, is not reality. And as long as we want to remain the distinction between a simulation and reality, that question remains. What is it, and is it really that? And that's not just a matter of performance. There's no, if it's just a nice simulation, it would be not different from a sort of emotion-sensitive doll, you know? So the girls in the room, perhaps, if you grew up with a doll that said, Mama, if you turn it around or something like that, you know, that's a good simulation. That's not different. It's only a matter of degree, not in kind, really, in difference. So, but I do think that I want to begin not with the machines, but with us. Because I think the reason why we are tempted to attribute to a material entity like a machine something like consciousness is because we have started to think of ourselves as merely material beings. I mean, if you think of what people tell you about neurophysiology and what the brain is doing, typically people will say, well, that's what your thought is, the brain process. Now, I think that's not right, and I will give you a number of reasons why that is. And if we see that, if we see that mind and matter must be different, then the plausibility of saying that a machine can suddenly think or be conscious in our sense is not as great anymore. At least it shifts the burden of proof. I think it will do something more too, but we'll see that when we get there. And that, I think, is in itself an important thing, just to shift the plausibilities a bit. Because we are so inundated by science fiction. I have read philosophical articles appealing to the witness of science fiction movies. They basically say, look, hasn't it been shown, you know, in, say, Star Wars, you know, these droids, they're so human-like, you know? That just goes to show that they can be like that too. Why would that show anything? That you can imagine that or make a science fiction movie doesn't prove anything. Thank you. I actually have something here. That is indeed a simulation. That we can imagine something does not prove that it is possible. That it is possible in a physical sense or even in a logical sense. It is just mere imagination, and it does not prove anything. But as I said, we are inundated with that, and that raises all the kind of plausibility that people appeal to. So what I want to do now is just go through a series of steps of arguments, all of which are to show that mind cannot be reduced to matter. And the first step is fairly well known from the philosophy of mind. It has to do with what people call qualia. I think sometimes people say qualia, but it has to do with quality, that's in that term. And that is basically the qualitative kind of feel that conscious states have. It feels like to be in a certain state or to have certain experiences. So for example, it is the way heat and cold feel. It is the way the clarinet sounds or coffee tastes, the way the rose smells, the way red looks. It is also something it is like to be in pain, for example. Can computers have pain? You can ask that question, for example. But so for us, though, we have these states and we know what it is like. And the question is, can that be reduced to material states? And the one who most famously has always argued about that is Thomas Nagel. And he says, you know, if you just open your skull, you know, while you're looking at something red or you're tasting coffee or something like that, let's say you're looking at something red and you open the skull and look at your brain, does anything in the brain turn red? No, it doesn't. You know, you might see neurons firing, but you don't see the redness that you experience when you look at something red. So it doesn't seem to be something in the material brain. Then the question would be, where is that? Or a more gross example, you know, if somebody eats chocolate ice cream and you lick at that brain, it will not taste like chocolate. So in the material brain, that is not itself where you see that experience, those qualia. The toothache might be in the tooth, but not in the same way as the blood vessels are in your tooth. So there is some difference here. In the history of philosophy, it's precisely these kind of states that people have said are merely subjective. So that colors, for example, don't really exist, it's just wavelengths of light or something like that, or that heat that we feel is nothing but kinetic energy. These are all material states. But it's precisely these subjective experiences that they have said are precisely that, just merely subjective. And precisely so after a clean physicalist kind of universe without those entities. But all the more then the question arises, where are then these subjective states if they are not in the physical reality? That in itself would be an argument for a certain kind of dualism between mind and matter. And then you cannot turn around and say, well, our mind is nothing but this physical process. You have just swept all these subjective states under the rug of being merely subjective. You know? And then you take that subjectivity and try to sweep it under the same rug. It's like trying to sweep the rug under itself. That doesn't work. You know? So some answer needs to be forthcoming on that. It is precisely because we cannot see what's going on in someone's mind when we look at his brain, that these are subjective and private states. You know, we cannot inspect them from the outside, as we would think we can do with all material processes. They are indeed something that's personal, and I know what it is like even if you don't. You know? If you go to the doctor and you say, I'm in pain, and the doctor tells you, well, I've inspected your body, you're not in pain, I know that, there's nothing wrong with your body. And I would say, well, I must know better whether I'm in pain or not. You know, that's not accessible physically. A further feature of these subjective states is that they are unified. So right now you're sitting in this room and you have all sorts of perceptions. You feel the chair that you're sitting on, you feel it's cold or hot, you see lots sorts of people and the board. These are all manifold kind of experiences, but they're all unified. They're all part of your consciousness, one field of consciousness. And you can also shift the center of attention. I mean, so you can move from one to the other. There's things in the periphery, there's some things in the center of your focus, but they're always all together there, and you know you can move around in it. So they form this kind of unified field. And that, too, is not something you can see in the brain. So if you have all these experiences, there are all sorts of material processes in your brain, but they're all discrete, they're all different from each other. They're not amongst themselves unified. Even such a simple thing as being in pain, you're in a state of pain, many neurons will be firing in your brain. But what makes these many neurons firing one state of pain? Nothing in the brain. You know? This is a feature that is, again, specific to mind and is not itself something material. From what I understand, in neurophysiology, there are different kinds of neurons that specialize in things, even in visual perception, on corners and angles and things like that. But they all have to come together to see one object. You know? What unifies that? These are different neurons and different types of neurons. So that also is then not reducible to physical things. And that is actually an important part of the mind in general, that we can unify things in this way. If you listen to a melody, for example, a melody is extended in time. It consists of many notes. What makes that one melody? Physically speaking, there are various notes coming one after another in time at my eardrums and so forth. But I don't perceive these separate kind of notes. I hear a melody, and in such a way that each note really has a qualitative character to it that depends on what is around it. You know, so the note is not just the note itself, but you listen to it as something that comes from what went before, but also you anticipate what comes in the future, which means that you can be surprised. You know, if it takes a surprising turn, that means you have expected something, and that all of that makes part of this unified experience of a melody. So it's true for shapes in space, but even of shapes in time, if you want. And that is not itself something that exists in this way physically. Even if you say a sentence, you know, that can have varying lengths, but there is a logical kind of unity to that sentence, and you must keep in mind where you come from when you're speaking and where you want to go, and then there's a full stop. But But then you have this unified kind of sentence, and that is not a physical feature again. And so these kind of arguments are also not entirely new. I mean, for example, Leibniz made them against Thomas Hobbes. And Thomas Hobbes was a materialist of some sort, and he thought it's just all your brain states, that's what your thought is. And he said, well, if that is so, then you can sort of take your brain and just make it larger, you know, blow it up sort of, and then you can walk into it like you would walk into a windmill, and you could look around, he says. And would you see anything there that resembles any of your perceptions or awarenesses or states of consciousness? And he said, no, there is not. And most especially, he said, what is missing is this unified character. So that's actually an argument that also has been around for a little while. Now, this is also then something that leads to the next point. That is intentionality as a feature of consciousness. And intentionality just basically means consciousness is always consciousness of something. I'm aware of something. I am afraid of something. I think about something. I hope something. All states of consciousness have an intentional object, as it is called. It's not intentionality in the practical sense. That's what we usually use. I have the intention to go somewhere or something like that. It's more generic in that sense. All states of consciousness have this feature. And that is not something that you can track in physical objects. So if you have, typical example, I'm billiard balls, right? So if you have one billiard ball bouncing into the next, and so this is also the timeline perhaps. So you have a causal kind of series. Now, this billiard ball is causally affected by this. So number one, two, three, four. So that's causality. But it is not somehow for billiard ball number two to be bumped into by billiard ball number one. It doesn't say ouch or something like that, or hop louder, something of that sort. It's not aware of that. So it doesn't have the qualia, first of all. But that would then, if it were aware of it, then it would be aware of billiard ball number one. And that's, if you see that, you see that this is a different kind of relationship than the physical causality that is going on. It is actually the opposite direction. It is causally upstream, if you want. But that is exactly what intentionality is. It's it is sort of the physical process in consciousness bending back on itself, becoming aware of itself. So you are aware of what causally affects you. And that's happening whenever you, let's say, this is you, this is your eye, right? So you're seeing something. But that means the object that you are seeing is physically affecting you. Oh, good, thank you. So I'm not sure it will do better, but it's, oh, yeah. So you need that. I mean, you wouldn't see anything unless there would be things causally impinging on your retina and so forth. So the causality is there, but your awareness of all of that is different. It's, again, it's causally upstream. It's the other direction. And again, that is not a physical feature. That is a feature of consciousness and of the mind. And in fact, it is precisely those things that people have tried to get rid of again in modern philosophy and say that the material world, the physical world, doesn't have any of these features. There's another one that tried to sweep under the rug, but now it comes back and says, well, but then it cannot be physical, and that's true in a sense. And so certainly not something you see in your brain. That, again, is also true, you know, for emotional life. You always love something or someone. And mere chunks of matter don't fall in love with each other, and computers probably not either. So that perhaps explains what Alan Turing meant in that that statement. Now here's another interesting aspect of that. If you think of that intentionality and our awareness of that, this is actually not just in our mind, it is in our body as well. So it spreads back onto our body, if you want. So as Raymond Tellis says, it spreads over the whole body like a blush. It literally animates the body. It makes the body alive. It makes it a living body. And so if I touch this desk with my fingers, that sense of touch is actually not in my brain. It is in my fingers, and that's where I feel it. So my awareness of the world is literally embodied. I do experience the world in and through my body. So this intentionality actually, even though it's a state of consciousness, colonizes, if you want, my body and works in and through and with it. And that makes my body alive. Now, that is one difference than I think our body has from a machine body. A computer doesn't blush, right? Maybe you can program to do it, but it's not in the sense that we have. That's a response of our consciousness that actually affects the whole body in that way. And it literally makes the body alive. Now, we can talk about things like that too, and especially computers. We talk about computers as if they have intentions or intentionality. So, for example, we say that robots are seeking something or monitoring something. They're trying to do something or taking something to be the case. Some missiles, we say, seek heat, you know, heat-seeking missiles. Are they really seeking something? That's a form of intentionality. We say they detect key presses that try to initialize their printers. They search for available devices. Or if you take a thermostat and you put some ice next to it, then it mistakes the room temperature for something else. You know, it makes mistakes. All of these are intentional states that are not literally there in the computer. But the reason why we speak like that is because the computer is a tool, our tool. Right? So if I use a tool like this pen, I can use that to write. So it's an extension of my intentionality. Any tool is an extension of my intentionality. And so we describe it that way, if it sort of works semi-autonomously, because we have invested it with that intentionality. It lends its intentionality from us, but it doesn't literally have that. Which explains why Alan Turing says computers cannot make literally mistakes. Because you can only make mistakes if you intend to do something. Without an intention, there's no mistakes. It's just a brute fact. You know? Something is happening, but not a mistake. Now, Daniel Dennett, you might know Daniel Dennett, a famous atheist, calls that the intentional stance. You know, we interpret machines as if they have intentionality because it helps us to track better what they are doing. It is a convenient abbreviation or something of that sort. But it's merely our projection, he says. And for once, I think we should agree with him. Right. Always have to find some points of agreement, right? So. But he takes it a step further. He says, the same is true for us. So for us, there's also no intentionality, really. We are also just like machines. But then where do we take it from to invest other things with it? You know, you cannot give what you don't have. You know? So if everything is an illusion, then, well, where does that illusion come from? You know? So I think that is actually where it does not work, but I think it is true for other kinds of things, namely machines. Animals, on the other hand, presumably are more like us. Animals have qualitative states that can be in pain. That's why we protect them, for example. And they have intentionality. They can seek things. They might be hungry and pursue food. And in all of that, they are very much like us. So this is not even anything specially human.
This is just about consciousness as such, and if we attribute consciousness to animals, that's also what they will have. Now, if we just think on that animal level, so I just said an animal can pursue food. What does that mean? It means it is looking for something that is not there. Otherwise, you don't seek it. You don't seek anything that's there, right? That's then when you have found it. So there's a sense of absence there. So something that is not, there's a sense of negativity and absence. And that might sound trivial, but it isn't. What is negativity, actually? What is absence? It's a feature in consciousness here somehow, but it does not really seem to be a physical feature. Physical things just are. There's nothing negative in physicality. And yet, that is something that arises with the mind. We expect things that are not there. We hope for things that are not there. Or, the reverse, we remember things that are not there anymore. They can become present, but they're at the same time absent. They are present precisely as absent. And if you say that a computer remembers something, that cannot mean the same thing as it does for us, if it is a feature of the mind. What happens in the computer is the actual physical states that we interpret to be memory. But a computer, in a literal sense, doesn't have memory. Sounds perhaps strange because we are talking about a computer having X amount of memory, but that's not memory in the strict sense of the word. What you have in the computer are physical states, and they're always positive as such. There's actually a curious feature. If you say you can have plus and minus, right? So minus is negativity. Just the signs on the board, they're positive physical things. There's nothing about the physical parts of these marks on the board that makes for any kind of negativity here. That is what we interpret it to be because we know what we mean, but it's not a physical thing. Now, interestingly, a double negative makes a positive, right? An odd kind of feature. But a double positive doesn't make a negative. Which means you can understand the positivity of matter with a feature of the mind that includes negativity, but you can never get from something purely positive to a notion of negativity. That is something that really occurs only with this feature of intentionality. That's where it emerges. And that is, again, a feature of mind, not of matter. This then leads to a third point. That is semantics. So semantics is a feature of language. It is the meaning of words, right? Words mean something, and that means they are about something. And that is a feature that is derivative from intentionality, because we in our mind can mean something. If I think a thought is a thought about something, and if I put the thought in words, then the words will be about that I think about. So the very semantics of our language that we use and that we understand when we understand language has these features. So meaning, and aboutness, let's call it aboutness. And again, the question then might be, can computers mean something in that way? Can they have semantics? And here comes again the, maybe you know that the Chinese room argument by John Searle. So imagine yourself, you're sitting in a room where you are charged with translating Chinese into, say, Polish, and you don't know either language, but you have sort of a chart. Whenever somebody slides in a word from one side, you're sort of secluded there, you can look up in the chart which word corresponds to that in the other language, and you slide it out the other way. But do you know what you just translated? Do you know what that means when you do that kind of process? Do you know the semantics of these worlds? No, you don't. You know, you might hear sort of laughter on the other side and you realize, oh, it just pushed through a joke, but you don't quite know which joke it was. You know? Or people are insulted, perhaps. But you don't know that. You just correlate these things. And that's basically what an algorithm would do in a computer. You know, so computers have gotten pretty good at translating things, you know, but it's still nothing but correlating things in a way that matches then the outcome in our use of language. But it's there might be the algorithm, but there's no semantics. There's syntax, but not semantics. You know? And so that is, again, then dependent on the mind. And if we lack something in terms of knowledge in that Chinese room, well, that's exactly what a mind normally does, and that's not accessible to machines. And if that is so, again, another way in which we talk about computers might also have to be put in question. We talk about information in the computer. Computer's information, but information has precisely these semantic meanings. It's information about something. So in a strict sense, we shouldn't be saying that there's information in the computer. We cannot help talking that way, you know, but I think we have to be aware that in the strictest sense of the word, that is not really there. We interpret the states of the machine as being indicative of that information, but it's not something in the machine itself. And so if that is so, you know, then so many states in the computer depend on our mind for it to be what it is. But then you cannot turn around and say, well, then our mind is nothing but a computer too, because again, we cannot give what we don't have, you know. So then you would get into an infinite regress. Where do we get that from, you know? Perhaps from God, you know, but usually we don't think that way. You know? We do have actually real minds ourselves. Now, fourthly, is about universality. That's by its nature, that's a bit more abstract, unfortunately. But it is the state where we actually, I think, go beyond the animal mind now. All these other things, in many ways, are then in the animal too. And but universality has to do with rational thought. You know, if we talk about intelligence, perhaps that's one thing that we should have in mind. And so we can articulate universal features of the universe. We have language that means something. You know, so we can have the word Fido in mind, we mean a particular dog. You know? So that's the semantics of the word Fido. But I also can just say dog. Right? What does that refer to? Well, all the dogs in a way, right? Dogs in the past, dogs in the present, dogs in the future, dogs that never exist, possible dogs. We mean all of them when we say dog. It's a universal term that refers to the dogness of all the dogs that can be or have been. So now, where do we find that sort of thing in the brain? First of all, again, there's just neurons firing, nothing that looks like it. But let's say we would find somewhere in the brain the word dog being written, you know, as a physical thing. Well, the word dog is yet again another particular material thing. It has not these universal features. It is itself particular. Universality as such cannot be found in that way in a material thing. And so by its very nature, it is particular and not universal. We can know that this physical word dog written in the brain or on the board means all of these things, but again, that is our mind doing that. It is not a feature of the physical thing itself. So that's a first way in which universality does not occur in matter. Any material thing is particular. Let's say I think the universal thought of a circle, you know, circularity. this might approximate a circle. It's intentionally bad. And I might be able to draw a better circle, right? But what does it even imply that I can say it's a better circle? Yeah? I must have a standard by which I judge that, right? And that standard is circularity as such, a perfect circle, which I only can approximate in material things. So this universal term of circle in this case has a precision and a perfection that no material thing can have. So our universal thoughts, by their very nature, cannot be material in that sense. They will always be imperfect in some sense. Now, even if, let's say, I have drawn a perfect circle, you know, hooray, you know, let's say I did that. Even that doesn't quite get me there, because it will always be one particular circle, not circularity as such. How many circles are there? Infinitely many, right? So any material thing is a particular, but there can be infinitely many circles, and I mean all of them when I think circle. That itself cannot be a feature of matter, and yet it is a quite clear and precise thought I have in my head, and you understand what I'm saying right now. You know? We can together entertain this one universal thought with all our different brain states that we might have at the same time. But itself, it cannot be one of these brain states. You know? And you know, you might think, well, perhaps I can design a computer that has an algorithm that says draw circles, you know? And maybe it's doing that very well. As we pointed out, that this kind of thing also is not literally in the computer. So for one, who decides which kind of circle it's going to draw if it is about all the circles? You know? I know that perhaps I can adjust that. It's not different from, let's say you have a compass and you can do that at any kind of diameter that you want. You know? That's not something in the compass. I can do that. I can spread it out in all these different kind of ways, and I'm the one who can know that. But let's say you see somebody using a compass and drawing a circle, and you say, oh, that's what it does. What he does, and he's just drawing circles. And you see him drawing one circle, and two circles, and three, and four, and five, and suddenly he makes a little swerving motion out of the circle. He says, what's that? You know, he just violated his algorithm, so to speak, didn't do the right thing. But maybe I observe him further, and after a while he's doing the same motion. He says, oh, there's some regularity to it after all, maybe he intends to do that, you know? And maybe I misunderstood what he was doing. But perhaps as time goes by, he might do even yet other things and there are different patterns emerging. Whatever I observe, it is actually not clear on the physical level of behavior what that person is doing. And the same is true for any algorithm that a computer is following. I mean, what the algorithm is or should be is actually also just in my mind. It's actually also not literally in the computer, because the computer might do something, but again, perhaps it makes that swerving motion. Maybe it's misprogrammed or something like that to do that, and it wasn't meant to do that. The algorithm that it was meant to perform was different. There's a gap between that, but there's nothing in the computer and the physical behavior of the computer that decides which algorithm it's implementing right now. That is in my mind, it's not in the computer. So that's even more startling, perhaps. There's no algorithm in the computer, if that is true. All that operates, there are physical laws, and they operate always, whether it violates the algorithm or not. So these are two different things. Now, on the other hand, if I draw circles and I make swerving motions or something like that, I know what I do because I know what I intend to do. I know the program I intend to implement here. My mind is completely transparent with regard to that meaning and the universal feature of this algorithm or procedure I'm trying to do, or drawing circles. You know? That in for any material state, that is my interpretation. It's coming from the outside. It's extrinsic to the material process. But what is in my mind is that meaning, that intention is intrinsic to my mind. Mind intrinsically has meaning. It means something and therefore is quite determined and clear in what it is trying to perform. So again, that's another way in which mind and matter must be different. Computers do work with one and zero, right? So the discrete states, and so you have binary kind of codes and so forth. One and zero again have plus and negative and so forth, and that is again not literally in the computer. And what you have are different kinds of state, but they're in each case physical states. And physical states are not discrete in the same way that one and zero are discrete. The physical states in the computer are always something, and they are actually more continuous than one would like for the discrete thought process that they are to instantiate. And that's actually something that Alan Turing acknowledges too. So he calls a computer a discrete state machine. And he says, these states are sufficiently different for the possibility of confusion between them to be ignored. Strictly speaking, there are no such machines. Everything really moves continuously. But there are many kinds of machine which can profitably be thought of as being discrete state machines. Convenient fiction that each light switch must, it's a convenient fiction that each light switch must be definitely on or definitely off. But there must be intermediate positions, but for most purposes we can forget about them. So to read a computer as being on and off in that way, in a discrete way that it's meant to implement, is actually a fiction, he says. And many of you probably know more about the technology than I do, but physical states indeed are, for one, positive, and they are also a continuum of causality. They are not discrete in the way that our thoughts are discrete. I can say yes or no to a particular statement, but a statement is self-contained. It's a full stop at the end, and it's discrete from the next thought. And there's nothing, again, in matter that is of that sort. So all of these are features of universality. And the discreteness might be another thing, but the universality that I've talked about earlier, the universal thoughts we think. And there can be dots, there can be circles, but we can also form one totally universal thought, and that is the thought of everything, all, right? And what do we think if we think everything? I mean, it's not that we know everything, but we know what we mean when we say everything. We mean everything, all the things that there are. Now, there is an odd feature of that, because the thought of everything must contain itself. Because the thought by which you think everything is one of everything. It's one of the many things that there are. Which means that that thought in itself is self-reflexive. It turns directly on itself. And that feature of reflexivity is another feature that is specific to the mind. Reflexivity. And that's, I think, an interesting one. Because that is something that we do all the time. Whenever you use the first person singular, I, you refer to yourself. You know, in that very act, you mean yourself. And I mean, so if people talk about computers becoming self-conscious or something like that, one would have to ascribe something like it, like this to this machine, to a material thing. But if reflexivity is not a material thing, there's no reason to attribute that to a computer. Physical things cannot literally refer to themselves. Even the parts of our mind that include a certain kind of physicality are not reflexive. So hearing, for example, is not reflexive. You cannot hear yourself hearing. Why? Well, you need a physical organ, namely the ear, to hear something. If you want to hear your hearing, you need another ear to do that. right? The ear doesn't hear itself, right? You need another ear to do that. So physical organs don't work that way. But thought can do that. A thought can be self-reflexive. That is why you can have such odd things like the liar paradox. And if I'm saying right now, I am lying right now, is that true or false? It's true if it's false, and false if it's true. But it's sort of perhaps something you shouldn't be doing, but you can do because you have this feature of reflexivity. You can, the thought can reflect on itself in its very own performance.
And again, that is a feature of mind, and mind is independent from matter.
If a material thing were to do something like that, this would be like taking a briefcase and putting the briefcase into itself. That doesn't work, right? How would it work?
So we can do that, material things cannot. You might have sort of a reflexive loop, say in a machine, you know, so like a feedback cycle or something like that. But that's not the same thing, because that is a later state being affected by an earlier state that is still sort of in the causal timeline, whereas reflexivity happens here and now in the very same act simultaneously. And that is not, again, physical. Here's a formulation by Karl Rahner, the theologian. He says that's a feature of subjectivity. And a subject, he says, is a system which is once more confronted with itself as a whole, and hence cannot simply be thought of on the lines of a computer made up of different parts, which in spite of all built-in controls, cannot once more manipulate itself as a whole. So perhaps an example might be a simple thermostat. So the thermostat has a certain setting, and so it will detect, if I might say so, it's also metaphorical, which temperature is in the room, and according to that, it will set in heat motion the heating or the air conditioning or whatever it might be. So very simple kind of feedback loop that way. So that has a certain kind of circular structure, but it cannot reflect, I mean, to take that quote, on itself as a whole. And that means what it cannot do is it cannot change its own setting. Now, I know there are now much more clever thermostats that can do something that might have a learning algorithm or something like that in them, but whatever that might be, there's an ultimate level of a kind of an algorithm that controls the whole thing. And the thermostat cannot come to think, I don't like that. I just reflected on myself and my algorithm, and I don't like it, and I want to do something else. We can do that. That's different. So there is something in that reflexivity that also has to do with creativity and spontaneity. You can come to reflect on yourself and re-envision yourself. It's a form of self-transcendence, you know, this kind of reflexivity. And again, that might not be something, or it is really not something that a computer can do on an ultimate kind of level. And that's important, I think, if people make all sorts of claims about the singularity emerging, you know, and the computers becoming smarter than us, and they're upgrading themselves. I'm wondering what that means, you know, and that would be a matter of argument, and again, I don't know the details of the technology, but just as a matter of principle, if that is true, then they cannot upgrade themselves. We can do that. We can learn in that way, you know, and we can re-envision ourselves. But there's almost an ultimate level that a computer cannot transcend. And so no computer can build a computer better than itself, I think, you know. So it's a little bit like an algorithm is like a recipe. So you're cooking meatloaf or cookies or something, and you follow a certain kind of recipe, there are certain steps you go through. But typically, cooking is a creative process. You know, you can taste it and say, oh, I want to do something different here, you know, and be creative about that recipe. That would not quite work in the same way for a computer. And I guess there are cooking robots now, you know, that you can program to follow certain recipes. But I think there would be still that difference. So there is a kind of creativity that comes with reflexivity.
And of course, it is more generally this feature of self-consciousness, which is specific to mind, and perhaps only to the human mind, by which we can say I to ourselves. Now, if I reflect on myself, if I become aware of myself, I in some way step away from myself, I transcend myself, I split myself into a subject and to an object. So I'm the one who's looking at myself. I'm on both sides. I'm the one who's looking and I'm the one who's looked at. So there's a certain gap that opens up in myself, and yet I am both, right? So there's identity and difference. And so self-consciousness has this feature of identity and difference at once. That's what makes that's necessary for it to be self-consciousness. Now, the distance I have from myself, the difference that I have from myself, then, is not a physical distance. It's not a distance in time, not in space. It's a distance of a different kind, and not one, again, that can be physical in nature. So self-consciousness itself is not a physical feature. The self and the identity of the self is also something simple. Here's another feature then, simplicity. The thought of myself, the saying I to myself, is a very simple thought. Has nothing to do with any kind of contents or memories or something that I might or might not have. You might have lost your memories. You can still I to yourself. It's a simple thought. You refer to yourself and to the whole of yourself. Now, how do you do that? If I mean the whole of myself, that is not, again, if you want to think of it as a physical process, and you take this piece of paper, can say one part of the paper reflects on itself, one part touches another. You know? But it's just half of the paper touching the other half. If I want to think of myself as a whole, that touches each of the parts. And that cannot be done by physical things because, okay, then I would have to continue to fold it until really every part of the paper touches every other part. How often do I have to do that? Infinitely many times. And once I have done that, what do I have? A point, a geometric point. And what's the extension of a geometric point? Nothing. There is no extension, by definition. And that then cannot be physical because something that's not extended physically is not physical. So that by itself, this sort of simplicity is itself something that transcends material states. So simplicity of our self-consciousness, it's part of our reflexivity, is not something that can be material by itself.
It can affect materiality then later, but the underlying simplicity is not itself something physical. So I think that is interesting because so
we sometimes think, well, maybe if you just build machines complex enough, suddenly consciousness will emerge. And perhaps we think in evolution, organisms grew to become more and more complex and sophisticated, and so finally then self-consciousness emerges. But the problem is that simplicity has no degrees. It cannot be built up by levels of complexity. It's either there or it's not there. That's a real leap. And that leap is not a matter of complexity, it's precisely simplicity. You know, when people talk about intelligent design, they sometimes talk about irreducible complexity, you know, try to say that must be a matter of design. This is not about irreducible complexity, it's about irreducible simplicity. And it is of a totally different kind. So there's a real leap here that just by itself transcends material complexity. And so just by building machines more complex doesn't mean we should expect them to have a mind or be self-reflexive or have self-consciousness. That then would rather require a further transcendent cause to be made present. And so here's where we can get theological. That might be God. That might be seeming like, no, I'm suddenly introducing God here. It's actually not me. I have found several texts from atheists and materialists who actually at this point start to appeal to God. They're sort of as a move of desperation, I think. So they say, well, why would God deny this poor computer a soul after it has become so nicely complex and fast and so forth, right? But what kind of an argument is this? I mean, people talk about Deus ex machina, but it's literally Deus ex machina. Where does that suddenly come from? So Alan Turing is one of those who says that at the end of his article. And so where does he suddenly come up with that idea? And then he suggests, well, maybe, you know, it's our task to form these mansions for souls in which God can then insert the soul, you know? Because Alan Turing suddenly talking about God creating a soul. But that's sort of a very strange idea, and there's no really reason, any reason to think of it, let alone for somebody who might be a materialist, you know? You might have theological arguments about that, why God might or might not do that, but I think just coming from the perspective of just mere artificial intelligence and so forth, that is not something one should assume. And because they feel there is something that needs explanation if one claims that, they suddenly start to appeal to God. We can talk more about that perhaps in the Q&A if you want. But so I found that interesting that people at this point appeal to God because there is a leap that is not just a matter of more material complexity, there's something else going on. The simplicity I talked about is also classically in Plato and others one of the features that make people argue for the immortality of the soul. Soul has this kind of simplicity that makes it, if you want, unbreakable. If something doesn't have parts, you cannot break it, you know, it cannot fall apart. Death is something where things come apart, you know, your body falls apart and so forth, and the soul leaves the body, we say, you know, and then the body falls further apart. But the soul cannot itself fall apart. So people will then argue that it's immortality of the soul based on that simplicity. So that's interesting and leads indeed then to the whole question of the soul itself and where it comes from and where it goes. The only thing that could put the soul in an order of existence then would be indeed God. Because God is simple in an ultimate sense. For the soul to cease to exist would mean it separates itself from its existence. All created things can do that, because all created things need a cause to put them into existence. Only God is so simple that there's not even anything you can put between God and his existence. He is existence itself. St. Thomas Aquinas says, and since this is a Thomistic Institute lecture, should mention him too. God has that simplicity. God doesn't need any further cause for his existence. But all the other things need, and especially the simple things, they depend still on God for their existence and also to sustain them in it. And so God then is the one true singularity, if you want. And there are sometimes features of idolatry that come up with this singularity question and whether the computers take over the world. But God would be the only true singularity. And so perhaps one can say in conclusion, as long as we are not concerned for the immortality of a computer and its eternal salvation, and as long as we have no reasons to ask whether we should baptize a computer, so long we also don't have reason to believe in artificial intelligence in that sense. Thank you. I'm happy to entertain questions. Yes.
So it's clear that physical events can affect consciousness, right?
Yes.
Put your hand on stove, mm-hmm. you're going to feel that. And it's clear that consciousness affects physical events. So you feel the pain when you jerk your hand. So my question is, how and why physical events affect consciousness, and why consciousness, if it is a non-physical thing, needs this physical machinery?
Yes. Well, there's several aspects about that. For one, I don't think consciousness as such, or intelligence as such, needs a physical body. At least as a thought experiment, there can be disembodied minds, and the tradition that they're called angels. You know? And there's a whole angelology about that. So I think logically speaking, it's not absolutely necessary to have a body. But that's our nature. We cannot think without the body. And that is also why physical states can affect our mind. So there's, of course, a typical argument people make and say, look, if you have brain damage, you know, or you take a drug that affects your brain, you cannot think straight anymore, or something like that. So doesn't that show that your brain is your mind, basically? No, it doesn't. It only shows that the brain provides a necessary condition for thought, but not a sufficient condition. But it doesn't explain all these things yet. It doesn't mean that the brain is the physical organ of thought either, because as I said, that wouldn't work. I mean, like your sense organs, they have a physical organ, but they also don't have some of these features. So for Aristotle and Aquinas, the brain is not the organ of the intellect. The intellect doesn't have a physical organ, cannot have one. It has operations that are not themselves physical, and they're independent from physical things. Nevertheless, being human in nature, having mind and body, Aristotle would insist that all of our knowledge begins from the senses. So basically, you must have something to think about. The senses provide you the material about which you can think and which you can labor to abstract the concepts of the universals and so forth. And that then makes it very plausible that if you affect your brain negatively, you know, then your thought processes don't work as well anymore, because you don't have the necessary input. So it's a necessary condition for us, but not a sufficient condition. We're not reducible to it. Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you for the talk. Mm-hmm. So I have a question about simplicity of the soul. Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting that you tied that to the immortality of the soul, mm-hmm. because death is a kind of breaking, right? And the breaking is kind of a violation of the simplicity mm-hmm. to the soul. So I think that's beautiful, but I just worry why being created wouldn't be a problem that death would be. So if death is a kind of breaking, it seems like coming into existence would also be a kind of abrupt breaking of a kind of simplicity, right? And within the Christian framework, souls aren't so eternal in God, right? It has to be created kind of after God, in a sense. And so if that's the theology we have, then why is being created not a break simplicity that death would?
Yeah, obviously I did at that point a lot of things very quickly and briefly, but so for one, it's the creation is indeed putting us together with our existence. There's still a composite there, Aquinas would say. But on top of that, being created in the body, of course, is even more, makes us more complex in that way. Yeah, I wouldn't call it a breaking, but it is a composite. But that's simply the nature of our soul. I mean, Aquinas would say, unlike angels, our souls are not as powerful, spiritual, that they could completely operate without the body. And so we need the body for the input, as I just said. But even though we are then rather complex, there is that simplicity at work. There is this unity that we have that unifies all of us. I can be self-aware as living in that body. So that simplicity starts to permeate even my physical being. This is actually underlying even the kind of unified field I talked about initially. So what makes it unified? One might think, you know, there's the center and that's the simple point, and then you have the periphery. It's not exactly like that, because the simplicity of the mind is there throughout the whole field. It's almost like God in the world. You know, it's everywhere and nowhere at once. The simplicity is important even in the manifoldness of our life, both our conscious life and our physical life. It unifies us in a way that no other material being is unified. And that then at the end would be broken in death, but that theologically speaking, you would also think about the resurrection where it's put together again too. Perhaps an even higher unification. That's a matter of speculation. But so that there is a, it's the one of the many, you know, at play here, the simplicity and how it unifies the many and so forth. That many features have to do with that. Yes, we have an almost first.
So you opened this talk with discussions of like how machine sentience might interact with like social and political norms that might apply to machines if they have sentience. So my question is as follows. So assuming there is a machine that can perfectly simulate sentience, but it doesn't actually have sentience, for a person who does not know about its true nature, how will it know that it's a simulation and not a person, given the features of the mind as not noticeable or, like,
yes. Well, that's sort of the, let's say, the epistemological question, how do I know, right? And I have consciously avoided that because I think if you start there, you don't get anywhere, right? And that's actually not different from even how do I know that you are conscious, right? You know, I mean, it might be what people call a zombie, no offenses. It's a technical philosophical term, you know? It means you can imagine it's like us in all things, but doesn't have a mind, you know? And so how do I know that I'm not the only conscious being in the world? I think if you start with probably know what argument to get you anywhere, I think one should begin with the normal assumptions that we have about what a human being is, you know, and then to think of other things in the world, including computers and other machines, and why or why we should not attribute consciousness to them or any kind of moral status and so forth. And much of that depends on where you think the burden of proof is. And I've tried to shift that burden of proof a little bit in this talk, you know, if nothing else, you know. But I think there's also at a certain point a real gap that opens up, an explanatory gap, you know, where should that suddenly come from if it is very different. Yes, please.
One is a curiosity and one is a question.
Yes.
First one is about the ontology that you've chosen. In the introduction, it was mentioned that you had interest in Leibniz, and I did some research on Bouvet, the Jesuits in China, and you can actually trace back AI to the binary system to Leibniz.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering, a lot of this is based on the predication of dualism. Even though you kind of hint at monism and monads, there's still this, as if there is this, there is some contradiction between materialism and soul, spirit.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, so the curiosity is, why not go with the immanent vitalistic materialism? So then we don't have, most of these questions would disappear because we would think of matter differently. We wouldn't think of souls differently as much as we would think of matter differently. And then the second one is, if it is true that this singularity is not unlike the computer singularity of omniscience, because which is the like the whole monad, wouldn't that also be in danger of being like the Cartesian demon? Maybe there is a god, but he's the demon.
Yeah, the Cartesian demon is more like the mad scientist. I totally wouldn't want to think of God that way. Yeah, let's leave that for a moment. But the first part of the question, I think, is important. So I'm very aware that I actually should now turn around and do something, one more step. So once I have said all these features are not in the physical world as commonly understood, I would say they have a certain kind of existence in the physical world nevertheless. Not as they have in the mind, though. But there is intentionality in nature, for example. Aristotle would call that final causality. Things have an intention, if you want. People talk about physical intentionality. Some philosophers actually have come to see that. Because things have a tendency to do something rather than another thing, by that very nature. So certain chemicals have a tendency to interact with other chemicals by their very nature. That's like they have the intention to do that in a physical sense. It doesn't mean, though, that they are conscious of that or that consciousness is involved. This is really a different kind of way of being. I mean, likewise, the qualia. Yeah? So if you say, well, our experience of red is really not just subjective in the mind, it doesn't really exist in reality, it's just wavelength. Well, maybe that's not true then either. Maybe it also has a material kind of existence of another way. But that doesn't mean that the red bag here, for example, is conscious of its redness or has a red experience, but it's a physical way in which that exists. So a lot of these features, you can actually look back and say, well, maybe there's a different way in which physical things have those without that being a form of consciousness. Take, for example, universal concepts. Aristotle would say that the universal concept of dog informs the particular dogs. That's what makes them dogs. You know, that's what's a substantial form that unifies the dog, as opposed to other things around them, and so forth and so on. So I think you can turn around and do that. None of this means, though, that these are psychological states. Again, the redness of the bag is not a psychological state of the bag. One has to make that distinction somehow, and I think that's where I would say I'm not a panpsychist in that way. It's a different kind of thought to combine those things. But that would be a different talk again, but I'm very aware that I have started from a reductionist understanding of what physics is in the first place.
So you talk about reflexivity and this ability of seeing all parts of yourself. Why do you think that you can do that? Reflexivity and this ability that you're saying you see all parts of yourself. Why do you think you can do that? I would argue that you can't do that.
I don't think so either in that sense. What I mean is, and it's also not true that we can truly change ourselves either. The thing is, we can want it. That is a matter of desperation. A computer cannot start to dislike its source code or something like that. But I can do that about myself. I might try to change everything about myself, but I might not succeed. But even that is more, I think, than a physical thing can do. And in the extreme case, I mean, Jean-Paul Sartre would always point that out, you can commit suicide, total rejection of yourself. So you're right. I mean, that doesn't mean that everything is possible to us in that way. But still, we can try, we can relate to ourselves in that way.
Right. But you made an argument about, putting a suitcase inside itself and holding the paper so it touches all parts of itself, as though the other side of that argument was that humans could do anything comparable to that.
Yes, I think we do. If I say I to myself, that's exactly what I do.
But I would argue that you can't, that's not the I that you say is not really you. It's like a projection of you that's much smaller.
Then I think you would never get the idea of an
I. The what?
You never get the idea of an I. You might talk about something, but the very notion,
why should the idea of an I be bigger than you?
Bigger than you.
What if the idea of I is smaller than you actually are?
It is in some way, in the sense that only in the sense that the attention to the I that I might not be completely aware of. But I can mean myself. It's just the same as I say everything. I can mean everything without knowing everything. And that thought itself, independently from the I, also is reflexive in that very way that it includes itself. And again, I want to say that's a feature of the mind that's not materially instantiable. So it doesn't claim complete knowledge of yourself, but it does claim a certain complete return to yourself. And at least in anticipation, but in the anticipation itself. Without that, you wouldn't even get the very thought of saying I to yourself. Animals don't do that.
Presumably.
They don't prefer that
substance. Reflexivity, you appeal to this idea that computers can't. They can't refer to themselves in any way, and all computers operate with algorithms that are fixed. They operate deterministically.
Yeah.
And that's definitely true, at least during Alan Turing's time, when all of his, you know, most groundbreaking papers came out. But I think in the last 5 to 10 years, the field of artificial intelligence has been revolutionized, so to speak, by deep neural networks.
Mm-hmm.
And the premise of which is that these are algorithms that can learn to adjust themselves based on data. And recent work by Google and stuff have even shown that there have been networks that learn to adjust the learning algorithm that adjusts the network itself.
So
technology has, I guess in the last 70 years, some like found traditional ideas about machines have been shown to, you know, been broken by new advances.
Yeah.
And my question is, like, can you ever imagine a future where, like, our technology or our software, our understanding of such progresses to a point where we might be able to have computers sort of refer to themselves with reflexivity and stuff?
Yeah, that's still two different things. So I have been actually interested in that and try to find out what people do know with computers, and I get different answers on that. So some people would say, yes, there's deep neural networks and things like that, and but there's a basic algorithm on which they still proceed, I think, that itself cannot be changed. Now, you might tell me something else. I would like to see that. But that's an open question for me, and I don't quite know what that means. I'm not sure that it means the same as reflexivity. It means it's a causal process, a kind of a feedback loop that affects the computer for the next stage of time, you know, and might produce some changes. That's a different thing from being self-aware, I think. You know, even if it affects even the source code or whatever. You know. So that's what I think. But that's actually a point I would like to know more about myself. Again, I get different answers from different people.
Yes.
So if somebody chooses to shift, you know, their attention away from the things that cause them to be intentionality there, and they choose to get rid of meaning, they choose to, like, detach themselves from universality, and to stop, like, referring to themselves, can they effectively, like, forfeit consciousness? And then, you know, based off of that question, like, is free will and consciousness related?
Free will is actually a thing I left out of, but it has something to do with that. I think material things also cannot have free will. Some of that has to do also with these features of reflexivity and spontaneity in that sense. Now what you are suggesting though is sort of to go the opposite, you have to take that down from the top down, right? So I reject my simplicity and I reject my the spontaneity and reflexivity and so forth and so on. I don't know by what power you would do that, if not by the very same power that you reject. Namely, the reflexivity, creativity, and perhaps free will that goes with that. You decide to do that. As I said, I mean, Sartre would say you can always commit suicide. Can a machine commit suicide? You can program it to be self-destructive. But that's not the same as committing suicide in a way. That's the ultimate kind of self-rejection, and for Sartre, that's the act of freedom. But it means to do that is a form of a self-contradiction within freedom itself. So, but you cannot take yourself down in all the ways that we said without using precisely that which you're rejecting. That makes sense. Mm-hmm.
On a similar note, when you say that a person has free will, that's something that you believe, but I think would be difficult to prove. It's more of a philosophy than a fact, right? I mean, you can't, like, so what I mean by that is, how do you, just from starting from, like, from pure facts, how would you deduce that people have free will as opposed to reacting to randomness around them? And then the reason I ask that is because if you say a computer can't program itself, well, there could be randomness in the environment, or just things that happen in the environment that mutate or change the structure of the computer. So, for example, a thermostat could heat up a room,
And if it gets so hot that it changes the physics of the thermostat and changes the physics of the thermostat.
And that's an accident. But, you know, I have a good talk on free will.
Yeah.
I would be so happy to give it to you. I wouldn't be sure where to begin right now. I think there's more than argument. That's not just a matter of faith that we have free will. And again, I would have to open up a word can of worms.
I guess one moment then is like if you say that a thing can't have free will or can't learn by itself, and you imply that we have to program everything into a computer, or like that we program a computer with an algorithm and execute that algorithm. But what about why couldn't it self evolve like how people could based on what you may call randomness in an environment? So you give it an intention with an algorithm, but then stuff happens and the underlying structure changes and does something different, kind of like evolution.
Yes, but that's not free will.
Exactly. Well, that's what I'm wondering. What's the difference between what you would call free will?
Well, free will has to do with our rationality. So we have rational intentions that we pursue. Free will is not a feeling or an experience or any of that sort. It is us pursuing rational goals. And that we can do that, of course, in itself, that we have free will. If looking into the brain will not show that, looking to our feeling states will not show that. It has to do with reasoning. And that was also not random, or reactions to random things. It's not reaction at all. But that would really need more unpacking.
So please join me in thanking Professor.